Yeah, I'm in many places all over. And I keep my back, I never keep my backups from the same spot. So I'm an experienced computer user, so I know to keep, you know, when you run a business and you have everything and you're hooked onto the software, when you make a backup tape, you put it in a safety deposit box. You take it to the bank once a week, and you make daily backups, and once a week, you take it to the safety deposit box. And we've had to sometimes call on it. We had when somebody actually erased accidentally the stuff. So, you know, losing a week's worth of work is a lot of money, but it's better than losing everything that you have.
Wow.
So that's what you did.
Daily backups?
We make daily backups, and a weekly backups we move off. We used to when I worked in this company. It was a software company. Everything we had was on the computers. Everything, all of our intellectual, everything was there. So we used to take it to a safety deposit box at a bank and deposit it there. That's what we did with it for safekeeping. Because if there was a massive, if the building burned down with Lockmart and Flan, what's going to help that you can have some backup tape sitting in an iron box that was going to burn too. So anyway, that's what we did. Anyway, enough of that. I'll.
Well, you can get fireproof tape.
Yeah, but you know, I'm not. What's
yeah,
that?
Probably
yeah, yeah. They do sell them. They do sell them. But I'm a nervous person. I think taking them to a bank is the way to. I think that was the way to go. Okay.
Have they gone to this?
What's that?
No,
not really, because you're talking, when you have a big company, you're talking about, you're not just talking about a gigabyte, you're talking about hundreds of gigabytes of data, so still tape. Anyway, it was when I was in the business. Now I'm in the total business, I don't know how they back that up. That all fits on TV, believe it or not. So let's talk about, actually, since you brought up the issue, I'll talk about dating. The dating is actually very easy to remember. The year 1000 before the Common Era. David starts to rule. King David starts to rule. His rule goes through the year 1000. Solomon builds his temple, I believe, 990. Right about... No, hold on. Sometime in the middle of the 900s. I can't remember off the top of my head, but in the 10th century BCE, that is when the Gideon... That is when the temple is built. So just to give you a framework as far as, you know, our reckoning now, that's the way it would be. Okay, so be that as it may, we're going to learn one verse in Malachim. I said in my post that we're going to be able to do most of chapter 5. I don't think we'll be able to do that. I think that's overly aggressive. We're going to do one verse in Malachim, but in order to do one verse in Malachim, we're going to learn a whole bunch of other Sfarim. And based on those other Sfarim, we will interpret the verse in Malachim. The other Sfarim are pretty cool. So, I have some extra sheets. If you need, I'll just put them around here and there. And I'll translate everything. There's plenty. The pasuk which interests me, and of course... So what did I, on my posting, on my email posting, I said, so was Shlomo the Mashiach? So the quick answer would be, of course not, otherwise we wouldn't be sitting here in New Jersey, West Orange, post-Holocaust, if Shlomo was, in fact, the Mashiach. But
which isn't the Mashiach post-exile?
That's correct. Mashiach is post-exile. That is our view of things now. That is our view of things now, where things get really bad, Mashiach takes us out of exile, brings us back home, and makes everything all better. That is a view of Mashiach. It's not the only view of Mashiach, but it's certainly the well-accepted view among today's circles, especially because we're so influenced by the mystical circles. Mashiach ben Yosef, Mashiach ben David, we're so mystically oriented, we don't even know we're mystically oriented, but we're so mystically oriented that, you know, the very fact that we sing L'cha Dodi, you know who wrote L'cha Dodi? L'cha Dodi was Alcibiades. Alcibiades was not your... not just your average guy. He was a Lurianic Kabbalist. He was one of the biggies. Is that right? Was he Lurianic? Was he before? Mm-hmm. Lurianic, right? He was in that group. So, you know, we're so influenced by it, we don't even realize how Kabbalistic we... We don't even realize how Kabbalistic that we are. But the views of Mashiach, I think what I'll demonstrate is a little more complex, but just look at the Pasuk. By itself, the pasuk looks very straightforward. So everything is going well. If you remember, the economy is going well. He's built sort of a military economy, which is fine. He's conquered most of the world. Not that he rules... I'm sorry, let me get my watch out of here. It's not that he rules most of the world, but most of the known world is paying some kind of vassalage to Shlomo. And even the queen, even the king of Egypt, is sending his daughter outside to marry Shlomo. And the reason what that does is show you that the balance of power is in Shlomo's time. Now, a few classes ago, I demonstrated that was not the mighty 20th dynasty, nor was it the mighty 19th dynasty. It was an interim dynasty. So it was certainly not Egypt at its most powerful. It was a time when Egypt was running through a lot of difficulties. Nonetheless, still, for the pharaoh to send out his daughter was a considerable thing, indicating Shlomo's wealth, power, etc. So chapter 5, verse 5 reads as follows. Vayeshev Yehuda l'Yisrael. Judah and Israel sat lavetach, with security, safely. Ish tachat dafno, every man in his own vineyard. V'tachat te'inato, under his own fig, fig vineyard, or whatever it is. I assume he has more than just one tree, otherwise he's not going to be very happy for long. But, orchard, a fig orchard.
No, figs are not exactly
what's that?
Figs are not exactly staples.
Well, back then I think they may very well may have been. I think figs were probably very significant food.
Cakes of figs.
Yeah, they used to.
Are spoken of as expensive stuff.
Yeah, it's true.
It could be like a currency.
Yeah. They used to make
right,
these.
Right, but that, I mean, it's not something that you need to live.
It's interesting. The question is why do that? You know, it is a little for us. It's not anachronistic for us. When we look at it, we wonder, you know, why Tenato? Why not the Bisaro or So the question is, you know, what about the cattle? What about other things? I think going back then, I think Te'inato probably was a high-priced item, not so easy to grow. You could also say tomorrow. The question is, where does this Te'inat come from? There's probably, Te'inim have a certain, they're used in all kinds of, they pop up now and again in Jewish, not only in Jewish legal texts, but also in Jewish holiday texts as well. But I don't know all the details, so I don't want to surmise. In any event, everybody has their own money, their own property, their own goods, producing midan va'ad Be'er Shava, from Dan to Be'er Shava. Now, Dan is where Dan is more or less today, Nachal Dan, if everybody's ever been up to Golan Heights. So if you want to do the easy hike, that's by Nachal Dan. What do? You go to Kiryat Shmona, you hang a right, you go past Chor Shatal, which is this beautiful camping ground that they have there, you go a little bit up into the Golan Heights, and you're in Nachal Dan. It's this beautiful, it's a very easy walk, it's a beautiful river that runs through, and it's where the ancient Dan was. They've actually dug it up, and learned all kinds of interesting things, and of course they found a great altar there, which shouldn't surprise you, because we'll find out that later an altar will be built there. The southern city, by the way, is Be'er Shava. Now I want to take, before we get into Mashiach, this does tell you something about the borders of Israel at the time. It seems a little contradictory, because right before this, we had Shlomo's people up all the way in the north, all the way to Mesopotamia. We also had Shlomo's people all the way down to the Nile of Egypt. Now whether that's Wadi al-Arish or whether it's the Nile, it's hard to say, but nonetheless, it's not Dan Vad Be'er Sheva. Dan Vad Be'er Sheva, if you went into Israel politics today and you said, I want to make sure that we keep the borders of Israel, will be from Dan to Ad Be'er Sheva, you won't make it a day. You wouldn't make it a day. So the question is, what are these borders? It's very strange. So the truth is, I mean, nobody knows for sure, but if you take a look in the Torah itself, the Torah does lay out two sets of borders, which Rav Yoel ben Nun, a great Tanakh scholar in Israel, calls Greater Israel and Lesser Israel. Greater philosophical religious Israel, the need to spread out Israeli culture and Israeli monotheism, culture meaning monotheism, that was supposed to go from the river of the Euphrates to the river of Egypt, again, either Wadi al-Arish or the Nile. That's a philosophical extent of Israel, trying to say that between the two great powers, the Mesopotamian powers and the Egyptian powers, you need to spread out your roots to those areas to allow your culture of monotheism to spread out. Practically, you probably had four or five Jews living in Lebanon, you got a few hundred Jews living in Syria. The population itself lived in what we think of as Israel proper. Those borders are also laid out in the Torah. It says, Ani etein lecha kol eretz Kanaan. And if you take a look in Bereishit chapter 9, where it lays out the lands of borders of Canaan, it says very specifically that you go down to Sodom and cut a left over to the Egypt. Eilat is not in Israel, in the lesser borders of Israel. The line cuts more or less through Be'er Sheva. So what you're looking at here is two sets of borders, which is, to my mind, the reason why I'm saying it, I guess I am being a little political here, it pays to, when approaching any kind of Israeli politics, whether ancient politics or whether modern politics, keep in mind that there were always these two borders of Israel. There was the Greater Israel, which Israel had the right to extend its power, perhaps vassalage, its morality and philosophy too. And there was Israel proper, Israel proper, reach to Be'er Sheva, not too much farther than that. I'm not going to draw by saying it never went to Gush Katif. I know it never went to Gush Katif. You never, ever had Jewish presence in Gush Katif. Now, again, I'm not trying to be political. I'm not trying to say we should give it back and don't give it back. There are reasons to and there are reasons not to, and it's not an issue that I, as a Tanakh teacher, are going to solve.
What you're saying is that Gush Katif as such was really never...
No, actually, it was. Gush Katif was, because the border, if you take a line from... No, I was saying something else, but I want to make sure I'm not misunderstood. If you take a line from Sdom, which is Eretz Canaan, and I hang it down to Wadi al-Arish, I do cross Gush Katif. So Gush Katif winds up being in lesser Israel as well. What I was trying to say is that no Jews ever lived there. It was always the Philistines. And after the Philistines, it was other people. There was the king of God. We'll read the Malachim. At Judaism at its greatest, during Chizkiyahu and Yoshiyahu, there's still... Oh, you're looking at the... You have borders there of...
It's all...
Yeah. Dan is up... You look for Yam Kineret and go a little bit north of that. There's Dan.
Yeah.
Right, so that's a pretty minor, that's not major Israel, that's minor Israel. So actually, Gush Katif is a little bit of a problem because it always was part of technical Israel as listed in the Torah, both Israels, both lesser and greater, but you never had Jews living there, ever. Not Aza, not Gat, not none of that territory. The whole strip was never, you just never had, I'm sure you had some Jews living down there. As we know, Shimshon went down to hang out there and to, go dancing with the girls. But you never really had a Jewish presence down in that area, which is something to be noted. But certainly I'm not trying to make any political statements. I'm just saying when you look at these issues, they're never really quite as black and white as people want to make them on either side of the fence. It's a complex issue of what Israel was all about. And populated Israel is from Dan to Be'er Sheva for a very simple reason. Past Be'er Sheva, if anybody's ever gone to Mitzpe Rimon, it's a beautiful town. But if it wasn't for modern irrigation, you couldn't live there. Ben-Gurion lived in a beautiful little kibbutz with trees growing everywhere, but those trees wouldn't have grown 2,000 years ago. People would die 2,000 years ago living in the middle of the Negev Desert. People just didn't go much south of Be'er Sheva because there was no significant way to survive. It was for tribes. The Edomites were down there because they lived in caravans. It was like if you ever go down to the Dead Sea, so occasionally you see the Bedouin. You ever see the Bedouin tents? That was the only way to survive. If you couldn't irrigate, you couldn't grow stuff. You follow the sheep? Do you want to?
Well, there is a difference. This isn't talking Torah.
Yeah, I know. That's my fault. I opened the subject.
Europe was heavily forested, and as a result of the climatic conditions in Israel were different.
You're saying that they were significantly better because of the forestation in Europe?
Yep.
That's possible. That's certainly possible. I'm basing all this on my knowledge of modern days, so it's always possible that it changed. Yeah, it's certainly possible. Then we have to find another reason why the Jews didn't go past Be'er Sheva. It could have been also for security reasons. You had a lot of nomads running around. And how far could you spread out without getting in trouble? So maybe it was military and political and safety rather than the climatic reasons. The climate reasons, which I thought. So that's very, it's very interesting. All of our dates, the fact that the temple fell in 597, all of our dates about what happened are all based on the sighting of Venus. There's a tablet out of Mesopotamia that has a sighting of Venus. They had Venus sighted at a certain place when there was, a lunar eclipse. So based on that, astronomers were able to, they were very careful about this, this happened, I believe, in the year 790 BCE. And based on that, they were able to tell when everything happened, because it was in the X year of a certain king. And based on that, we can tell exactly what year who ruled and what year the temple fell and when Nebuchadnezzar came around. So what's interesting is a teacher of mine, who was a great Assyriologist, so he was talking to astronomers, and he said, all that is wonderful, as long as the orbit of Venus never changed in the last 3,000 years. So he said to him, you mean the orbit of Venus can change? He said, it is theoretically possible. And if the orbit of Venus changes, then all of our dates that are in every scholarly book that you will ever read are off. Is it probable? No. But is it possible? Yes. And it's something to keep in mind. Things change, so you have to be careful when you date back. It's true. Sometimes it's guesswork. Anyway, getting back to the pasuk. The pasuk appears to be only. It's like all good. Vayishev Yehuda Yisrael v'etaf yistach gifno v'etaf yistein atom yidan v'asheva kol yimei Shlomo, all the days of Shlomo. If it weren't for the fact that those words are incredibly, they resonate in other parts of Tanakh. that expression of tachat gafno and tachat tanato, you probably heard. It probably comes up in prayers and various other things. And the reason why it comes up is because it shows up three times in Tanakh. Here, and two other books were written at later times, and I have to tell you, two other eschatological books. That is, two books dealing with the end of days, with messianic times. And those are the books I'd like to take you to now. Let's read them, and I'll show you that those phrases are borrowed from this text in Shmuel. In which case, if a later prophet is describing Mashiach using terms that he sees by Shlomo HaMelech, the question is, what then can we posit about that prophet's view about what was going on during Shlomo's time? If you put it together, it can indicate that the prophet felt that Shlomo's days were either messianic or so close to messianic that they deserve to be integrated in their own prophecy. So let's take a look and see what this is. First one is Micha, Perek Dalet. Micha, Perek Dalet. And I will read it, but you'll immediately know it's talking about the end of days and messianic times in the first three words. V'haya ba'acharit ha'yamim, and it will be, v'haya is future tense, v'haya, haya is past, but v'haya is future, v'haya ba'acharit ha'yamim, right away you know you're talking about, you're in Kabbalah, essentially, you're in messianic times. Yiyeh, and if that wasn't enough to know, it gets better. Yiyeh har beit Hashem nachon b'rosh ha'harim, the mountain with the house of God will be firmly established at the head of all other mountains. V'nisahu migvaot, that will be raised up higher than any other hills. V'naharu alav amim, and all the other nations will come like naharim, like rivers to it. They will all, it's a verb which comes from the word river, it means they'll all flow through Shlaim. This, by the way, is a similar prophecy you have in Isaiah, in the second chapter of Isaiah, so you may recognize it from there as well, but Micha puts it a little bit more clearly, so I thought I'd cite Micha. V'halchu goyim rabim v'amru l'chu v'na'ale al har Adonai v'al beit Elohei Yaakov. Everybody, non-Jew, Jew-alike, everybody wants to go up to the temple. V'yoreinu midrachav, and we will learn from his ways. V'nelcha v'orchotav, and we'll go in his path, God's path. Ki mitzion tetei Torah v'ar Adonai v'shlaim. Good stuff, right? It's very quotable. Very quotable stuff. That Micha, very quotable guy. V'shafat ben amim rabim. And God will judge these nations. Now, that's not necessarily a negative thing. Remember, the word Shabbat shows up in Shlomo's time, and there's a reason I want to emphasize that. That'll be about the last thing we come back to, the issue of judgment. V'hocheach l'goyim atzumim, and he will instruct other nations. Now, it's true, the word hocheach can mean to correct, but it can also simply mean to teach, to educate. Ad rachok, all the great nations, the strong ones from far away. V'kititu charvotehem l'diitim, they will take their swords and melt them down into plowshares, the chanitotehem, and their spears, the mazmerot, into, I don't know, whatever other kind of pruning, is that what it is? So, how about this one? You got more quotables. If Micha was alive, he'd be getting so much royalty, he could retire. He wouldn't have to be, he could get out of the whole prophecy business and retire. Lo yisu goyel goy cherev, no nation will fight against another nation, v'lo yul medun o no chaman, nobody will ever teach war again. The Yashvu ish tachat gafno v'tachat tenado. There's our line. And each person will sit under his vineyard and under his tenim orchard. Ve'im macharid, and nobody will be. Ve'im macharid is hifiel. It means nobody will cause him to be afraid. It doesn't mean nobody will be afraid. Nobody will cause him to be afraid. Kipi Hashem tzvaot diber, because God, the Lord of hosts, he's holding all of the cards, and he spoke. Every man will go in the way of God. Now the question is, what does Baal Ohav mean? Does that mean everybody goes after their own gods? Does that mean everybody has their own personal view of monotheism and they're all acceptable?
It's
okay for other nations. What do you have there in translation?
It says each man in the name of his God.
That's right. And that's part of the view prophecy. As far, and by the way, it does not have to shock you. That means that the Muslim could be after Allah, and the Christians could be after, well, at least the Father, perhaps not the Son and the Holy Ghost, but at least after the Father. And everybody, if they accept the moral aspects of Judaism, I should say Orthodox, I say Judaism just in a broad term, then that's great. You know, the seven mitzvot b'nei Noach, so to speak. The seven mitzvot b'nei Noach do require one not to blaspheme God, but it never... You know, it's weird. We always say, you know, don't blaspheme God. But they know about God. It's Abraham's time. Obviously, there's this conception that there is at least, you know, a God, who's their God, who shows them their ways. It's a very interesting prophet. And we'll go in our ways forever and ever and ever. This is eschatological time. By the way, we can learn Sefer Micha. The problem is it's all prophecy. There's no storyline, so you know it gets a little bit, you know, there's just so much beautiful poetry. I shouldn't say that. It's a beautiful book to learn, but without a storyline, it requires a little more oomph. Also, this is probably the easiest. This is the easiest four lines in all of Micha. Micha and Amos are not known for their easy reads. What we have here, if, according to Micha, that everybody sitting under their geffen and under their te'inah is the result of messianic times, then I have to say, you have to posit that he felt that Shlomo was living in messianic times. That Shlomo's people were living in messianic times. Is there anybody, besides the fact that Mashiach hasn't, except for the fact that we know for sure that Mashiach hasn't come, and we know for sure that Shlomo wasn't the Mashiach, is there anybody who can tell me why Micha wouldn't think that what was going on in Shlomo's time wasn't, in fact, messianic, post-messianic, or at least concurrent messianic times?
Well, I mean, was everybody well off at just Shlomo?
No. The pasuk is very clear. The pasuk says back in Malachim, Vayeshev Yehuda, word for word, Vayeshev Yehuda, almost word for word, Vayeshev Yehuda, Yisrael, the Vetach, everybody was secure, which means there was no war. That's another part of Micha's prophecy, although not word for word. Ish Tacha Kafno, V'Tacha Tenato, Midan Vad Ber Shava, Kol Yimei Shlomo. That's everybody. I mean, it's not everybody, and probably some people live in Egypt, some people here and there, but it was the larger population of Israel was living Tacha Kafno, Tacha Tenato. So my question when you're reading this is, tell me why Mashiach hasn't come during Shlomo's time, except the fact that we know it wasn't. You know, it's a little weird.
Well, what messianic times are.
What's that?
Other than to say what messianic times will be like, is back like it was in the day of Shlomo.
So what you're saying is it wasn't messianic times, but a good, if you want to know what it will be
like is.
I'll tell you, so it's not saying this is what it is, it's just saying this is your best, it's like a metaphor. Not a metaphor, but you know, the closest you can imagine. That's certainly a possibility. It's certainly a possibility. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Go ahead, please.
The introduction and the preface,
by all means, please,
to this book, it talks about that, and it says, during this era, Israel was at the pinnacle of spiritual achievement and the paragon of mankind. They were very close to the perfection necessary to usher in the messianic era. However,
right,
the Gentile nations had not yet attained their proper mode of conduct in respect to God's plan, creation. King Solomon was to use his era of Jewish preponderance and his plenipotentiary position to attempt to affect this end.
Oh, so that's...
But he wasn't able.
You know what I have a problem with that? Because then it's not our fault Mashiach didn't come. It's their fault Mashiach. I always thought Mashiach was in our hands, but apparently we can do everything right.
Better.
And it's still there. Guy stealing from somebody on 42nd Street, and I don't get Mashiach.
Not true.
What's
not
that?
True.
Why?
The point that we were not effectively able to teach them
exactly
the lesson.
It's a good point. What is this preface struggling with? The preface is struggling with
the exact thing
we're struggling with. The way it looks now is you have to explain why Mashiach didn't come if, in fact, messianic times... Now, the way that you explain it, Harold, you sort of got out of it in a different way. You said it was metaphoric, or at least it was an allusion rather than a direct. But the simple read is, this is the way it will be, and therefore that's the way it was. If X equals Y, and if X equals Y, and A equals Y, then X equals A. That is, if Shlomo was living in these conditions and the Messiah is in these conditions, then Shlomo was the Messiah. That's like Aristotle's syllogism. Of course, that's always dangerous, because if humans breathe and fish breathe, then humans are fish. So you can't always play syllogisms. There's no doubt about it. However, a simple read leaves you with the conundrum that text is giving you, which is, it was Mashiach's time, and yet it's clearly not Mashiach's time, so what do we do? So they have a reason why everything was okay on our part, but Shlomo wasn't able to get the rest of them to play in, which is okay, because Micha was describing how the other nations would also stop making war. However, I have to say that it does say in Shlomo's time that Israel yashav betach, there was no war. And in fact, it does say, ein milchama kol yimei, I believe, no, it doesn't say there was no war. I shouldn't say that. Don't say there's no one.
The book here goes on to explain the extent to which Shlomo did try to achieve this end in his later years. Solomon resorted to marrying foreign princesses.
How about that for apologetics?
And converting them to Judaism, he hoped to achieve a sphere of influence in each of these countries and influence them toward the recognition of the Lord. He was, however, unsuccessful. Unknown to him, in their hearts were not the love and glory of the Lord, but the regal lifestyle of Solomon's court. This liaison was to result in the Lord's splitting of the kingdom of Israel.
Actually, it's going to be worse. So what's going to result in, even if we want to assume that that was the only motivation of Shlomo, and there's certainly no reason to believe that Shlomo didn't want to spread his view of the way things are supposed to be everywhere.